more information than the obvious about a situation. And growing up in that climate, it pushed you to excel. It pushed you to look for more. It pushed you to really examine the thing in front of you. So it really made a difference in my upbringing. And I think I'm much better at that than otherwise, simply because Robert had such an impact on me as an older brother, as well as I see his coworkers, his listeners, and everyone else who enjoyed his company the brief time he was on this planet. But with that, I believe that pretty much sums up how I basically feel about him, and we'll surely miss him.
Certainly. And what are some of your memories of... I'm sorry, excuse me, I'm getting ahead of myself because there's so many people who we have lined up to speak about him. So we're going to actually thank you for being there. And there will be more shows like this where we certainly call you and hear more from you. And thank you, Alan, for your patience in our little technical kind of extravaganza this evening. And we will be in touch for sure.
Thank you very much. Oh, and one last piece of information, as well as Bobby, is what I call him, would pursue the story. Okay. I got him involved with golf, and he pursued that with a vengeance and became good extremely fast. He just is always amazing. And with that... thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy your evening.
And we'd also like to thank all of you who are tuned in to Earthwatch for joining myself, Catherine Davis, Paulette Spencer, for this special tribute program. And coming up will be Hour of the Wolf.
Better. My friends always say. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. Tonight, we haven't had rainbows on here in like 2 weeks. So, we're having it back because it is now September. Good morning. Well, a heady week again. Very lovely. I never met Robert's partner before. He's very nice, and it's nice to actually come in here and have a live person doing live radio before I come in here. That is as it ought to be. At any rate, last night. That is to say, Tuesday night, we began the new season, the 24th season of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, with Paul DiFilippo and Walter Mosley. And I gotta tell you, they are both really good performers. Paul did a wonderful thing, a very funny piece, and Mosley just held the audience. He is a natural performer. He knows the stage. He knows how to use his voice. He's occasionally on NPR doing his political commentaries are wonderful. But he was reading from his new novella, Jack Strong, and it was cool. And we were in a new space for us. We are at 388 Atlantic Avenue, which WBAI listeners may know the name of because it happens to be, more than happenstance, it is where WBAI's management offices are located. Our studios are here. Here? Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. You don't see us. We're in Harlem. We're at City College of New York in Harlem. And I'm not even sure what that neighborhood is called, 388 Atlantic Avenue. Is that Borham Hill?
I don't know.
I think it may be Borham Hill. But
I think the only neighborhood in Brooklyn is Park Slope.
No, I live in another neighborhood with another neighborhood name, and I won't say what it is. mine has a name, also. There's a lot of non neighborhoods downtown Brooklyn. It's not a neighborhood; it's a place. And 388 Atlantic Avenue is not per se a neighborhood; it's a place, but it's really nice.
It's a nice place.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever have gone to the Atlantic Antic and walked up and down, you've passed through there. And there was a time, I would say 20 years ago, where I would not have cared to be in that area at all.
No, not without a police escort.
Yeah, yeah. But today it's really...
Much different, yeah.
Very different, very cool, very
well,
nice.
Well, Brooklyn itself
and the owner of the building, the woman who is the landlady for WBAI management, was very good to us. So that will not be next month on October, whatever the first Tuesday of October is, when our readers are going to be Paul Park and James Morrow. There's an interesting juxtaposition. Yeah, yeah. Rick is, you need to see the face. Because, I mean, two people with, shall we say, challenging religious views. And by the way, David Silverman, if you can hear me, I would love you to host that night. David Silverman, only because his wife, Hildy Silverman, is the editor of Space and Time. It's the only reason I'm inviting David Silverman to. No, David Silverman is also the head of, what's the name of the organization? American Atheists? The group that Madeline Murray O'Hare,
the name,
difficult yeah. woman, used to be.
Right.
I engineered her a few times.
Right.
Difficult person. But David is now head of that organization. He's been on TV battling Bill O'Reilly. He won. he can be a little strident himself, but he's a wonderful guy. Anyway, that's but I haven't properly invited him yet. I have to send him an email. I just love the idea, though, of having Paul Park and Jim Morrow and just throw into that mix David Silverman, and people can come in and just be aghast at all of the various religious wonders and heresies that we can throw in together at one time. Not the first time we've done that. We had Jim Morrow and Charlie Pellegrino once. A better face from Rick now. So that will be the first Tuesday in October, and that will be back at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art at 138 Sullivan Street. And I'll tell you more about that as we get closer to the event. We will be back at 388 Atlantic Avenue the first Tuesday in December, when our performers will be
Eldon Kushner and
I was trying to think of the partner team. I've never heard any of them say wife and wife. They're partners. They're married.
They're married. Yeah.
They're married.
Yeah.
But they don't use the kind of terms that many married people use. They're partners or significant others, even though they've been together for a score at least, if not longer. That will be hosted by Claire Wolf Smith, as always, and we'll be back at 388 Atlantic Avenue for that. And you should all come, because it's a really nice venue and shockingly easy to get to, even though it's in Brooklyn. Even though it's across the river, there's like three subway stations nearby, including Atlantic Avenue. You can even get there by the Long Island Railroad. So, there. Anyway, so we had a nice turnout last night, and a good time was had by all. And I'd like to thank Open Road Media for... I had not realized they also represented Paul DiFilippo. And I'll tell a quick story why I put the two of them together. And then it's time to talk to Rick. The story is that when I told people at ReaderCon and on Facebook that we're going to have Walter Mosley, and this is his second time reading for us. He was there when Cherie Renee Thomas was the curator. Immediately, somebody said, oh, so who else is going to read? Samuel R. Delaney? No. Nora Jemison? No. Can you get a lie, Don Johnson? No. Why do we have to have... Why are you putting everybody into a box? Because we have Walter Mosley, that means it's Black Evening? It's like, no, you want a theme? I'll give you a theme. Walter Mosley is a mystery writer who writes science fiction. Paul DiFilippo is a science fiction writer who's written two mystery novels. There's your box. There's your bleeping theme. So next month, it's interesting religious views. November, Nick Kaufman and John Langan. I don't know what that theme is other than...
horror.
Semi-horror. November is sort of our... It's the event that's closest to Halloween, because since we're the first week of the month, it's too early to do it in the first week of October. But if we do it right in the beginning of November, we're close enough to Samhain. And this will be the last year that we're going to do just horror or whatever in that first week of November. From here on in, and I announced this last night and I announced this now on the air, every either late October or early November will be the annual Margot Adler Memorial Reading. She hosted there a few times, and that means stories of vampires, witches, and I guess NPR people. Oh, and we can probably find a writer or two who can put all of those into a single story. So that will start next year. And then December, it's family time. And then it's music month in January with Daniel Jose Older and Sarah Pinsker. And April is Samuel R. Delaney. I didn't say I wouldn't have him. I just said I wouldn't have him the same. And that'll be on his 74th birthday. Hi, Rick.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
So far, so good. Thank you.
Okay. Are there headphones in here?
There's a headphone right here, and I shall put it
on. Yeah, no, it was for me, though, to make sure that I'm putting you on the air properly. You don't need them.
Make sure you're putting me on the air properly.
You are on the air properly. I would not stint you, Rick. We don't have to go through the entire resume at the moment, and the broadcast that we are about to have runs 80 minutes.
So start
the
engine.
So we better start it.
Right now.
Yeah, pretty much. How did you come to write... Okay, this is the first chapter of a novel called Dust Devil...
Dust Devil on a Quiet Street.
I always miss that. I have a blank.
And I wrote this in 2005, which was well after 9/11. And it was a time when a whole bunch of stuff, other stories and songs and whatnot about that event, took place. I didn't know that that was going to happen. And I've written at this point, God knows how many, 72 stories, something like that. And this was just another story, but in fact, this story has done very well. It's been anthologized many times. It's won a couple of awards, and
it's a great story. It's
apparently so.
It's up there with some of your best, Rick. It's my opinion.
I thank God that I wrote it, but
I thank you that you wrote it.
Well, in terms of the story, I'm God, but Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, I mean, when you hear the story, Dust Devil continues the story of the narrator, and he continues the story of Mags and Jeff as well. That would be in subsequent chapters of the book. But I...
So you see, it's not just a fix-up novel, as you call it. Because there is a...
There's continuity from one... One of the things about a fix-up novel, which is taking a bunch of stories and turning them into a novel, the sooner you discover that you have a theme and that that's going to be the theme of a book, the better. It's less screwing around and there's more getting into the journey that is a novel.
Right.
And in this case, I had no idea that There's a Hole in the City was even going to be in this book until well into the development, because I'm a very confused writer indeed. But why don't we just play the story?
I think so.
Yes.
So what can I say? Prepare to just sit back and listen. I think you will enjoy it. So let me do the station break now. This is WBAI in New York City, and here we go. If I can figure out the right button to press. Of course, I took off my glasses. Let's see. I rarely use the CD players in here. This button? Oh, that should do. My name is Jim Freund. As you have been hearing on our promos, we are going to have a reading of Richard Bowe's very special story, There's a Hole in the City.
We didn't need this
fabulous
part, did we?
Piece of speculative fiction. And I am going to tell you all about Richard and Dr. Charles B. Strozier, who will be coming in after the reading is over to discuss this, and we will talk about the short story. But at this time, we're going to begin that story on such a very special day.
There's a Hole in the City, by Richard Bowes, Wednesday, 9/12/01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street and LaGuardia Place for my friend Mags to come up from Soho and have dinner with me. On the skyline, not 2 miles to the south, the pillars of smoke wavered slightly, but the creepily beautiful weather of September 11th still held, and the wind blew in from the northeast. In Greenwich Village, the air was crisp and clean, with just a touch of fall about it. I'd spent the last day and a half looking at pictures of burning towers. One of the frustrations of that time was that there was so little most of us could do about anything or for anyone. Downtown streets were empty of all traffic except emergency vehicles. The West and East Villages, from 14th Street to Houston, were their own separate zone. Pedestrians needed identification, proving they lived or worked there, in order to enter. The barricades consisted of blue wooden police horses and a couple of unmarked vans thrown across LaGuardia Place. Behind them were a couple of cops, a few auxiliary police, and one or two guys in civilian clothes with IDs of some kind pinned to their shirts. All of them looked tired, subdued by events. At the barricades was a small crowd, ones like me waiting for friends from neighborhoods to the south, ones without proper identification, waiting for confirmation so they could continue on into Soho, people who just wanted to be outside near other people in those days of sunshine and shock. Once in a while, each of us would look up at the columns of smoke that hung in the downtown sky, then look away again. A family approached, a middle-aged cop behind the barricades. The group consisted of a man, a woman, a little girl being led by the hand, a child being carried. All were blondish and wore shorts and casual tops. The parents seemed pleasant but serious people in their early 30s, professionals. They could have been tourists, but that day the city was empty of tourists. The man said something, and I heard the cop say loudly, "You want to go where?" "Down there," the man gestured at the columns. He indicated the children. "We want them to see." It sounded as if he couldn't imagine this appeal not working. Everyone stared at the family. "No ID, no passage," said the cop, and turned his back on them. The pleasant expressions on the parents' face faded. They looked indignant, like a maitre d' had lost their reservations. She led one kid, he carried another, as they turned west, probably headed for another checkpoint. "They wanted those little kids to see Ground Zero?" a woman who knew the cop asked. "Are they out of their minds?" "Looters," he replied. "That's my guess." He picked up his walkie-talkie to call the checkpoints ahead of them. Mags appeared just then, looking a bit frayed. When you've known someone for as long as I've known her, the tendency is not to see the changes, to think you both look about the same as when you were kids. But kids don't have gray hair, and their bodies aren't thick the way bodies get in their late 50s. Their kisses aren't perfunctory. Their conversation doesn't include curt little nods that indicate something is understood. We walked in the middle of the streets because we could. "Couldn't sleep much last night," I said. "Because of the quiet," she said. "No planes. I kept listening for them. I haven't been sleeping anyway. I was supposed to be in housing court today, but the courts are shut until further notice." I said, "Notice how with only the ones who live here allowed in, the South Village is all Italians and hippies." like 1965 all over again. She and I had been in contact more in the past few months than we had in a while. Memories of love and indifference that we shared had made close friendship an on-and-off thing for the last 30-something years. Earlier in 2001, at the end of an affair, I'd surrendered a rent-stabilized apartment for a cash settlement and bought a tiny co-op in the South Village. Mags lived as she had for years in a rundown building on the fringes of Soho. So we saw each other again. I write, obviously, but she never read anything I published, which bothered me. On the other hand, she worked on and off for various activist leftist foundations, and I was mostly uninterested in that. Mags was in the midst of a classic New York work and housing trouble. Currently, she was on unemployment, and her landlord wanted to get her out of her apartment so he could co-op her building. The money offer he had made wasn't bad, but she wanted things to stay as they were. It struck me that what was youthful about her was that she had never settled into her life, still stood at the edge. Lots of the village restaurants weren't open. The owners couldn't or wouldn't come into the city. Angelina's on Thompson Street was, though, because Angelina lives just a couple of doors down from her place. She was busy serving tables herself, since the waiters couldn't get in from where they lived. Later, I had reason to try and remember. The place was full, but very quiet. People murmured to each other, as Mags and I did. Nobody I knew was there. In the background, Rasvigi's ancient airs and dances played. "Like the Blitz," someone said. "Never the same again," said a person at another table. "There isn't even any place to volunteer to help," a third person said. I don't drink anymore, but Mags, as I remember, had a carafe of wine. Phone service had been spotty, but we had managed to exchange bits of what we had seen. "Mrs. Pirelli," I said, "the Italian lady upstairs from me. I told you she had a heart attack watching the smoke and flames on television. Her son worked in the World Trade Center, and she was sure he had burned to death." Getting an ambulance wasn't possible yesterday morning, but the guys at the little fire barn around the corner were there waiting to be called, I guess. They took her to St. Vincent's in the chief's car. Right about then, her son came up the street, his pinstripe suit with a hole burned on the shoulder, soot on his face, wild-eyed, but alive. Today they say she's doing fine. I waited, spearing clams, twirling linguine. Mags had a deeper and darker story to tell, a dip into the subconscious. Before I'd known her and afterwards, Mags had a few rough brushes with mental disturbance. Back in college, where we first met, I envied her that, wished I had something as dramatic to talk about. I've been thinking about what happened last night. She'd already told me some of this. The downstairs bell rang, which scared me. But with phone service being bad, it could have been a friend, someone who needed to talk. I looked out the window. The street was empty, dead, like I'd never seen it. Nothing but papers blowing down the street. You know how every time you see a scrap of paper now, you think it's from the Trade Center? For a minute, I thought I saw something move. But when I looked again, there was nothing. I didn't ring the buzzer, but it seemed someone upstairs did, because I heard this noise, a rustling in the hall. When I went to the door and lifted the spy hole, this figure stood there on the landing, looking around like she was lost. She wore a dress, long and torn, and a blouse, what I realized was a shirt waist, turn-of-the-century clothes. When she turned towards my door, I saw her face. It was bloody, smashed like she had taken a big jump or fall. I gasped, and then she was gone. "And you woke up?" "No. I tried to call you, but the phones were all screwed up. She had fallen, but not from 100 stories. Anyway, she wasn't from here and now." Mags had emptied the carafe. I remember that she just had ordered a salad and didn't eat that, but Angelina brought a fresh carafe. I told Mags about the family at the barricades. "There's a hole in the city," said Mags. That night, after we had parted, I lay in bed watching, but not seeing, some old movie on TV, avoiding any channel with any kind of news. And the buzzer sounded. I jumped up and went to view the screen. On the empty streets downstairs, a man, wild-eyed, disheveled, glared directly into the camera. Phone service was not reliable. Cops were not in evidence in the neighborhood right then. I froze and didn't buzz him in. But, as in Mag's building, someone else did. I bolted my door, watched at the spy hole, listened to the footsteps, slow and uncertain. When he came into sight on the second floor landing, he looked around and said in a hoarse voice, "Hello, sorry, but I can't find my mom's front door key." Only then did I unlock the door, open it, and ask her exhausted son how Mrs. Pirelli was doing. "Fine," he said, "getting great treatment. St. Vincent was geared up for thousands of casualties. Instead," he shrugged, "anyway, she thanks all of you. Me too." In fact, I hadn't done much. We said goodnight, and he shuffled on upstairs to where he was crashing in his mother's place. Thursday, 9:13. By September of 2001, I had worked an information desk in the university library for almost 30 years. I live right around the corner from Washington Square, and just before 10 a.m. on Thursday, I went out for work. The Muslim-run souvlaki stand across the street was still closed. Its owner and workers gone since Tuesday morning. All the little falafel shops in the South Village were shut and dark. On my way to work, I saw a three-legged rat running not too quickly down the middle of McDougal Street. I decided not to think about portents and symbolism. The big TV set up in the library atrium was still showing the towers falling again and again, but now they also showed workers digging in the flaming wreckage at Ground Zero. Like the day before, I was the only one in my department who had made it in. The librarians lived too far away. Even Marco, the student assistant, wasn't around. Marco lived in a dorm downtown right near the World Trade Center. Then had been evacuated with nothing more than a few books and the clothes they were wearing. Tuesday had been very upset. I'd given him Kleenex, made him take deep breaths, got him to call his mother back in California. I'd even walked him over to the gym where the university was putting up the displaced students. Thursday morning, all of the computer stations around the information desk were occupied. Students sat furiously typing email and devouring incoming messages, but the intensity had slackened since 9/11. The girls no longer sniffed and dabbed at tears as they read. The boys didn't jump up and come back from the restrooms red-eyed and saying they had allergies. I said good morning and sat down. The kids hadn't spoken much to me in the last few days, had no questions to ask, but all of them from time to time would turn and look to make sure I was still there. If I got up to leave the desk, they'd ask when I was coming back. Some of the back windows had a downtown view. The pillar of smoke wavered. The wind was changing. The phone rang. Reception had improved. Most calls went through. When I answered, a voice, tight and tense, blurted out, "Jenny Levine was who I saw. She was 19 years old in 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory burned. She lived in my building with her family 90 years ago. Her spirit found its way home, but the inside of my building has changed so much that she didn't recognize it." "Hi, Mags," I said. "You want to come up here and have lunch?" A couple of hours later, we were in a small dining hall normally used by faculty on the west side of the square. The university, with food on hand and not enough people to eat it, had thrown opens at cafeterias and dining halls to anybody with a university identification. We could even bring a friend if we cared to. Now that I looked, Mags had tension lines around her eyes, and hair could have used some tending. But we were all of us a little ragged in those days of sun and horror. People kept glancing downtown, even if they were inside and not near a window. The Indian lady who ran the facility greeted us, thanked us for coming. I had a really nice gumbo, French avocado salad, a soothing pudding. The place was half empty, and conversations again were muted. I told Mags about Mrs. Pirelli's son the night before. She looked up from her plate, unsmiling, said, "I did not imagine Jenny Levine," and closed that subject. Afterwards, she and I stood on Washington Place before the university building that had once housed the sweatshop called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. At the end of the block, a long convoy of olive green army trucks rolled silently down Broadway. Mag said, "On the afternoon of March 25, 1911, 146 young women burned to death on this site. Fire broke out in a pile of rags. The door to the roof was locked. The fire ladders couldn't reach the eighth floor. The girls burned." Her voice tightened as she said, "They jumped and were smashed on the sidewalk. Many of them, most of them, lived right around here, in the renovated tenements we live in now. It's like those planes blew a hole in the city, and Jenny Levine returned through it." "Easy, honey. The university has grief counseling available. I think I'm going. You want me to see if I can get you in?" It sounded idiotic even as I said it. We had walked back to the library. There are others, she said. Kids all blackened and bloated and wearing old-fashioned clothes. I woke up early this morning and couldn't go back to sleep. I got up and walked around here and over in the East Village. Jesus, I said. Jeffrey has come back, too. I know it. Mags, don't. This was something we hadn't talked about in a long time. Once there were three, and Jeffrey was the third. He was younger than either of us by a couple of years, at a time of life when that still seemed a major difference. We called him Lord Jeff because he said we were all a bit better than the world around us. We joked that he was our child, a little family cemented by desire and drugs. The three of us were all so young, just out of school and in the city. Then jealousy and the hard realities of addiction began to tear us apart. Each had to find his or her own survival. Mags and I made it. As it turned out, Jeff wasn't built for the long haul. He was 21. We were all just kids, ignorant and reckless. As I made excuses in my mind, Mags gripped my arm. He'll want to find us, she said. Chilled, I watched her walk away and wondered how long she'd been coming apart and why I hadn't noticed. Back at work, Marco waited for me. He was part Filipino, bit of a little wise-ass who dressed in downtown black. But that was the week before. Today he was a woebegone refugee in oversized flip-flops, a magenta sweatshirt, and gym shorts, all of which had been made for someone bigger and more buff. How's it going? It sucks. My stuff is all downtown where I don't know if I can ever get it. They have these crates in the gym, toothbrushes, bras, big razors, but never what you need. Everything from boxer shorts on out, and nothing is ever the right size. I gave my clothes in to be cleaned, and they didn't bring them back. Now I look like a clown. They have all of us sleeping on cots in the basketball courts. I lay there all last night staring up at the ceiling with 100 other guys. Some of them snore. One was yelling in his sleep. I don't want to take a shower with a bunch of guys staring at me. He told me all this while not looking my way, but I understood what he was asking. I expected this was going to be a pain, but given that I couldn't seem to do much for Mags, I thought maybe it would be a distraction to do what I could for someone else. Want to take a shower at my place? Crash on my couch? Could I, please? So I took a break, brought him around the corner to my apartment, put sheets on the daybed. He was in the shower when I went back to work. That evening when I got home, he woke up. When I went out to take a walk, he tagged along. We stood at the police barricades at Houston Street and 6th Avenue and watched the traffic coming up from the World Trade Center site. An ambulance with one side smashed and a squad car with its roof crushed to a halt up 6th Avenue on the back of a huge flatbed truck. NYPD buses were full of guys returning from Ground Zero, hollow-eyed, filthy. Crowds of Greenwich Villagers gathered on the sidewalks, clapped and cheered, yelled, "We love our firemen. We love our cops." The firehouse on 6th Avenue had taken a lot of casualties when the tower fell. The place was locked and empty. We looked at the flowers and the wreaths on the doors, the signs with faces of the firefighters who hadn't returned, and the messages to the brave men of these companies who gave their lives defending us. The plume of smoke downtown rolled in the twilight, buffeted about by shifting winds. The breeze brought with it for the first time the acrid smoke that would be with us for weeks afterwards. Officials said it was the stench of burning concrete. I believed, as did everyone else, that part of what we breathed was the ashes of the ones who had burned to death that Tuesday. It started to drizzle. Marco stuck close to me as we walked back. Hip 20-year-olds do not normally hang out with guys almost three times their age. This kid was very scared. Bleecker Street looked semi-abandoned, with lots of stores and restaurants still closed. The ones that were open were mostly empty at 9 in the evening. If I buy you a six-pack, you promise to drink all of it? He indicated he would. At home, Marco asked to use the phone. He called people he knew on campus looking for a spare dorm room and spoke in whispers to a girl named Eloise. In between calls, he worked the computer. I played a little Lady Day, some Ray Charles, a bit of Haydn, stared at the TV screen. The president had pulled out of his funk and was coming to New York the next day. In the next room, the phone rang. "No, my name's Marco," I heard him say. "He's letting me stay here." I knew who it was before he came in and whispered. She asked if I was Lord Jeff. "Hi, Mags," I said. She was calling from somewhere, with walkie-talkies and sirens in the background. "Those kids I saw and asked a place," she said, her voice clear and crazed. The ones all burned and drowned, they were on the General Slocum when it caught fire. The kid you saw and asked a place, all burned and drowned, I asked. Then I remembered our conversation earlier. On June 15th, 1904, the biggest disaster in New York City history, until now, the East Village was once called Little Germany. Tens of thousands of Germans with their own meeting halls, churches, beer gardens. They had a Sunday excursion, mainly for the kids, on a steamship, the General Slocum, a floating fire trap. When it burst into flames, there were no lifeboats. The crew and the captain panicked. By the time they got to a dock, over 1,000 were dead, burned, drowned. When a hole got blown in the city, they came back looking for their homes. The connection started to dissolve into static. Where are you, Mags? Ground Zero. It smells like burning sulfur. Have you seen Jeffrey yet? She shouted into her phone. Jeffrey is dead, Mags. It's all the horror and tension that's doing this to you. There's no hole. Cops and firemen and brokers all smashed and charred are walking around down here. At that point, sirens screamed in the background. Men were yelling. The connection faded. Mags, give me your number. Call me back, I yelled. Then there was nothing but static, followed by a weak dial tone. I hung up and waited for the phone to ring again. After a while, I realized Marco was standing looking at me, slugging down beer. She saw those kids? I saw them too. Tuesday night, I was too jumpy to even lie down on the goddamn cot. I snuck out with my friend Terry. We walked around. The kids were there, in old historical clothes, covered with mud and seaweed, and their faces all black and gone. That's why I couldn't sleep last night. You talked to the counselors? I asked. He drained the bottle. Yeah, but they didn't want to hear what I wanted to talk about. But with me? You're crazy. You understand. The silence outside was broken by a jet engine. We both flinched. No planes had flown over Manhattan since the ones that had smashed into the towers on Tuesday morning. Then I realized what it was. The Air Force, I said, making sure it's safe for Mr. Bush's visit. Who's Mags? Who's Lord Jeff? So I told him a bit of what had gone on in that strange, lost country, the 1960s, the naivete that led to meth and junk. I described the wonder of that unknown land, the three-way union. Our problem, I guess, was that instead of a real menage, each member was obsessed with only one of the others. Okay, he said. You're alive. Mags is alive. What happened to Jeff? When things were breaking up, Jeff got caught in a drug sweep. He was being hauled downtown in the back of a police van. He cut his wrists and bled to death in the dark before anyone noticed. This did for me what speaking about the dead kids had maybe done for him. Each of us got to talk about what bothered him without having to think about what the other said. Friday, 9:14. Friday morning, two queens walked by with their little dogs as Marco and I came out the door of my building. One said, there isn't a fresh croissant in the entire village. It's like the siege of Paris. We'll all be reduced to eating rats. I murmured, he's getting a little ahead of the story. Maybe first he should think about having an English muffin. Or eating his yappy dog, said Marco. At that moment, the authorities opened the East and West villages between 14th and Houston Street to outside traffic. All these people whose cars had been stranded since Tuesday began to come into the neighborhood and drive them away. Delivery trucks started to appear on the narrow streets. In the library, the huge TV screens showed the activity at Ground Zero, the preparations for the president's visit. An elevator door opened and revealed a couple of refugee kids in their surplus gym clothes, clasped in a passion clinch. The computers around my information desk were still fully occupied, but the tension level had fallen. There was even a question or two about books and databases. I tried repeatedly to call Mags. All I got was the chilling message on her answering machine. In a staccato voice, it said, this is Mags McConnell. There's a hole in the city, and I've turned this into a center for information about the victims, Jenny Levine and Jeffrey Holborn. Anyone with information concerning the whereabouts of these two young people, please speak after the beep. I've left a few messages asking her to call. Then I called every half hour or so, hoping she'd pick up. I phoned mutual friends. Some were absent or unavailable. A couple were nursing grief of their own. No one had seen her recently. That evening, in the growing dark, lights flickered in Washington Square. Candles were given out. Candles were lighted with matches and Bics and wick to wick. Various priests, ministers, rabbis, and shamans led flower-bearing, candlelit congregations down the street and into the park, where they joined the gathering vigil crowd. Marco had come by with his friend Terry, a kind of elfin kid who'd also had to stay at the gym. We went to this 9/11 vigil together. People addressed the crowd, gave impromptu elegies. There were prayers and a few songs. Then, by instinct or some plan I hadn't heard about, everybody started to move out of the park and flow in groups through the streets. We paused at street lamps that bore signs with pictures of pajama-clad families in suburban rec rooms on Christmas mornings. One face would be circled in red, and there would be a message like, "This is James Bolton, husband of Susan, father of Jimmy, Anna, and Sue, last seen leaving his home in Far Rockaway at 7:30 a.m. on 9/11. This was followed by the name of the company, the floor of the Trade Center tower where he worked, phone and fax numbers, the email address, and the words, "If you have any information about where he is, please contact us." At each sign, someone would leave a lighted candle and a tin plate. Someone else would leave flowers. The doors of the little neighborhood fire rescue station was open. The truck and the command car were gone. The place was manned by retired firefighters with faces like old Irish and Italian character actors. A big picture of a fireman who had died was hung up beside the door. He was young, maybe 30. He and his wife, or maybe his girlfriend, smiled in front of a ski lodge. The picture was framed with children's drawings of firemen and fire trucks and fires, with condolences and novena cards. As we walked and the night progressed, the crowd got stretched out. We'd see clumps of candles ahead of us on the streets. It was Great Jones Street in the Bowery that suddenly were just the three of us and no traffic to speak of. When I turned to say maybe we should go home, I saw for a moment a tall guy staggering down the street with his face purple and his eyes bulging out. Then he was gone. Either Marco or Terry whispered, "Christ, he killed himself." And none of us said anything more. At some point in the evening, I had said Terry could spend the night in my apartment. He couldn't take his eyes off Marco, though Marco seemed not to notice. On our way home, way east on Bleecker Street, outside a bar that had been old even when I hung out there as a kid, I saw the poster. It was like a dozen others I'd seen that night, except it was in old-time black and white and showed three kids with lots of hair and bad attitude, Mags and Jeffrey and me. Jeff's face was circled, and under it was written, "This is Jeffrey Holborn. If you have seen him since Tuesday, 9/11, please contact." And Mags had left her name and numbers. Even in the photo, I looked towards Jeffrey, who looked towards Mags, who looked towards me. I stared for just a moment before going on, but I knew that Marco had noticed. Saturday, 9:15. My tiny apartment was a crowded mess Saturday morning. Every towel I owned was wet. Every glass and mug was dirty. It smelled like a zoo. There were pizza crusts in the sink and a bag of beer cans at the front door. The night before, none of us had talked about ghosts. Marco and Terry had seriously discussed whether they would be drafted or would enlist. The idea of them in the army did not make me feel any safer. Saturday is a work day for me. Getting ready, I reminded myself that this would soon be over. The university had found all the refugee kids' dorm rooms on campus. Then the bell rang, and a young lady with a nose ring and bright red ringlets of hair appeared. Eloise was another refugee, though a much better organized one. She had brought bagels and my guest's laundry. Marcus seemed delighted to see her. That morning, all the restaurants and bars, the tattoo shops and massage parlors were opening up. Even the Arab falafel shop owners had risked insults and death threats to ride the subway in from Queens and open their doors for business. At the library, the huge screens in the lobby were being taken down. A couple of students were borrowing books. One or two even had in-depth reference questions for me. When I finally worked up the courage to call Mags, all I got was the same message as before. Marco appeared, dressed in his own clothes and clearly feeling better. He hugged me. "You were great to take me in. It helped me even more," I told him. He paused, then asked, "That was you in the poster last night, wasn't it? You and Mags and Jeffrey." The kid was a bit uncanny. When I nodded, he said, "Thanks for talking about that." I was in a hurry when I went off duty Saturday evening. A friend had called, invited me to an impromptu survivors party. In the days of the French Revolution, the terror, That's what they called the soirees, at which people danced and drank all night, then went out at dawn to see which of their names were on the list of those to be guillotined. On 6th Avenue, a bakery that had very special cupcakes with devastating frosting was opening again. The avenue was clogged with honking, creeping traffic. A huge chunk of Lower Manhattan had been declared open that afternoon, and people were able to get the cars that had been stranded down there. The bakery was across the street from a Catholic church, and that afternoon in that place, a wedding was being held. As I came out with my cupcakes, the bride and groom, not real young, not very glamorous, but obviously happy, came out the door and posed on the steps for pictures. Traffic was at a standstill. People beeped, "Here comes the bride," leaned out their windows, applauded and cheered, all of us relieved to find this ordinary, normal thing taking place. Then I saw her on the other side of 6th Avenue. Mags was tramping along, staring straight ahead, a poster with a black and white photo hanging from a string around her neck. The crowd in front of the church parted for her. Mourners were sacred at that moment. I yelled her name and started to cross the street, but the tie-up had eased. Traffic started to flow. I tried to keep pace with her on my side of the street. I wanted to invite her to the party. The hosts knew her from way back, but the sidewalks on both sides were crowded. When I did get across 6th, she was gone. Aftermath. That night, I came home from the party and found the place completely cleaned up, with a thank you note on the fridge signed by all three kids, and I felt relieved, but also lost. The survivor party was on the Lower East Side. On my way back, I had gone by the East Village, walked up to 10th Street between B and C. People were out and about. Bars were doing business, but there was still almost no vehicle traffic, and the block was very quiet. The building where we three had lived in increasing squalor and tension 35 years before was refinished, gentrified. I stood across the street looking. Maybe I willed his appearance. Jeff was there, in the corner of my eye, his face dead white, staring up, unblinking, at the light in what had been our windows. I turned towards him and he disappeared. I looked aside and he was there again, so lost and alone, the arms of his jacket soaked in blood. And I remembered us sitting around with the syringes and all of us making a pledge in blood to stick together as long as we lived, to which Jeff added, and even after. And I remembered how I had looked at him staring at Mags and knew she was looking at me, three sides of a triangle. The next day, Sunday, I went down to Mag's building, wanting very badly to talk to her. I rang the bell again and again. There was no response. I rang Super's apartment. She was a neighborhood lady, a lesbian around my age. I asked her about Mag's. She disappeared. Last time anyone saw her was Sunday, 9-9. People in the building checked to make sure everyone was okay. No sign of her. I put a tape across her keyhole Wednesday. It's still there. I saw her just yesterday. Yeah? She looked skeptical. Well, there's a World Trade Center list of potentially missing persons, and her name's on it. You need to talk to them. This sounded to me like the landlord trying to get rid of her. For the next week, I called Mags a couple of times a day. At some point, the answering machine stopped coming on. I checked her building regularly. No sign of her. I asked Angelina if she remembered the two of us having dinner at her place on Wednesday, 9-12. I was too busy staying busy so I wouldn't scream. I remember you, and I guess you were with somebody. But no, honey, I don't remember. Then I asked Marco if he remembered the phone call, and he did, but was much too involved by then with Terry and Eloise to be really interested. Around that time, I saw the couple who had wanted to take their kids down to Ground Zero. They were walking up 6th Avenue, the kids cranky and tired, the parents looking disappointed, like the amusement park turned out to be a ripoff. Life closed in around me. A short story collection of mine was being published at that very inopportune moment, and I needed to do some publicity work. I began seeing an old lover who'd come back to New York as a consultant for a company that had lost its offices and a big chunk of its staff when the North Tower fell. Mrs. Pirelli did not come home from the hospital, but went to live with her son in Connecticut. I made it a point to go by each of the Arab shops and listen to the owners say how awful they felt about what had happened and smile when they showed me pictures of their kids in Yankee caps and shirts. It was the next weekend that I saw Mags again. The university had gotten permission for the students to go back to the downtown dorms and get their stuff out. Marco, Terry, and Eloise came by the library and asked me to go with them, so I volunteered. Around noon on Sunday, 9:23, a couple of dozen kids and I piled into a university bus driven by Roger, a Jamaican guy who has worked for the university for as long as I have. The day before 9/11, these kids didn't much want old farts keeping them company, Roger had said to me. Then they all wanted their daddy. He led a convoy of jitneys and vans down the FDR Drive, then through quiet Sunday streets, then past trucks and construction vehicles. We stopped at a police checkpoint. Cop looked inside and waved us through. At the dorm, another cop told the kids they had an hour to get what they could and get out. Be ready to leave at a moment's notice if I tell you to, he said. Roger and I, as the senior members, stayed with the vehicles. The air was filthy. Our eyes watered. A few hundred feet up the street, a cloud of smoke still hovered over the ruins of the World Trade Center. Piles of rubble smoldered. Between the pit and us was a line of fire trucks and police cars with cherry tops flashing. Behind us, the kids hurried out of the dorm carrying boxes. I made them write the names on the boxes and noted in which van the boxes got stowed. I was surprised, touched even, the number of stuffed animals that were being rescued. Over the years, we've done some weird things to earn our pensions, I said to Roger. Like volunteering to come to the gates of hell? As he said that, flames sprouted from the rubble. Police and firefighters shouted and began to fall back. A fire department chemical tanker turned around, and the crew began unwinding hoses. Among the uniforms, I saw a civilian, a middle-aged woman in a sweater and jeans, carrying a sign. Mags walked toward the flames. I wanted to run to her. I wanted to shout, "Stop her." Then I realized that none of the cops and firefighters seemed aware of her, even as she walked right past them. As she did, I saw another figure, thin, pale, in the suede jacket and bell-bottom pants. He held out his bloody hands, and together they walked through the smoke and flames into the hole in the city. Was that them? Marco had been standing beside me. I turned to him. Terry was back by the bus, watching Marco's every move. Eloise was gazing at Terry. Be smarter than we were, I said. And Marco said, sure, with all the confidence in the world.
You've been listening to There's a Hole in the City, copyrighted by the author, Richard Bowes, who was the reader as well. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifico Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. The program is The Next Hour. My name is Jim Freund, filling in for the French couple who are at the moment in Belgium. That would be Janet Coleman and David Dozer. And with me are the author of There's a Hole in the City, Richard Bowes, and also, if you were listening to The Next Hour last week, Dr. Charles B. Strozier. And Rick Bowes has published 5 novels, 2 collections of short fiction, and over 50 stories. His work has won 2 World Fantasy Awards and the Lambda Award. He has just finished his latest novel, Dust Devil, My Life in Speculative Fiction. This story, by the way, was written and published online in Ellen Datlow's Sci-Fiction was a website run by the Sci-Fi Channel, where Ellen Datlow did one of the most remarkable jobs in the world, and of course the year that it was nominated for so many awards, it got killed. And Rick has lived most of his life in Manhattan. Many of his recent stories take place downtown and in Greenwich Village and the East Village of his youth. His website is located at rickbowes.com, R-I-C-K-B-O-W-E-S. Dr. Charles B. Strozier is a professor of history at John Jay and at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. He's also a practicing psychoanalyst and a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Training and Research Institute for Self-Psychology, or TRISP, in New York. Much of his work is focused on apocalyptic violence and related issues of terrorism, including his current study, just published in August by Columbia University, entitled Until the Fire Stopped Burning, 9/11 and New York City and the World, in the Words and Experiences of Survivors and Witnesses. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so, and you're both on mic. Excellent. Rick, I continue to marvel at that story.
Well, actually, I do also. It sort of came out of nowhere, and so long after the event, I mean, it's 3.5 years after the 9/11 that it was published, and a lot of the material were anecdotes that I had been, you know, telling people that what was it like, you know, in Manhattan at 9/11, and I would tell them these stories. And then, because I needed to get a story written, I used this material, and the response was incredible. It was 2005, and at that point, apparently we were far enough from the event that all manner of fiction and music concerning 9/11 began to be published. I guess it took that long for it to become encompassed.
Chuck, why does this resonate?
Well, you know, it's really an interesting story because it combines the just listening to you is fascinating. I didn't realize that it came out of sort of basically interviews and anecdotes you had gathered. It has the immediacy of first-person testimony, and you feel as though reading it or listening to it that you're listening to somebody who was actually there. And within that, immediacy that brings you back into 9/11 and the events of that day and the week or two afterwards, you then suddenly slip into this very exotic, almost science fiction tale, and the hole in the city that, of course, is a giant hole we all felt at the time. And I also like the way you weave in the triangle, the factory fire and the General Slocum, you know, so that these historical events that are so relevant for understanding the what occurred on 9/11 becomes a part of this story that's sort of first person testimony, history, and evocative fiction that draws us into the possibility of imagining this giant hole and death and afterlife and all kinds of associations that I had.
Well, the basic skeleton of the story is what I actually did during those days, and then around that I wove various fantasy tropes. But what I describe is what I was doing, waiting at the barricades for a friend to come up to see me, working at the NYU library. I was one of the only ones who could actually get in there to do it. I was very fortunate in that I had something to do. I think it was part of the helplessness that everyone felt was that there was nothing they could do. I did have something I could do. I could sit there, and the kids wanted somebody sitting there, somebody who was old and obviously not that easy to kill. You know, this gave them a certain amount of confidence. And so it was easy also.
Yes, there are a number of references to the fact that you felt useful being older than the younger people for the first time.
Yes, it wasn't normally something that they treasured, but in this, for a brief time, yes, that it was something, it was an advantage.
I felt some at John Jay College where, you know, we lost 68 alumni, and it's a college where firefighters and firemen get their higher degrees, and I had former students who died. And, you know, I think the same sort of thing. I created a terrorism center, and we had seminars, and I felt my sort of age and experience dealing with college students, many of whom were not only had the experience of their friends and colleagues die on 9/11, but then we're working on the pile. So, you know, it was a continuing experience of living and reliving 9/11. And, you know, sort of age, people you were treated with more respect because you had some history to make them aware of.
It didn't last. They went very soon went back to paying no attention to me at all. But for a few weeks there, I was a god.
There was a pull in the media. There was a period of time when we came on. I had a Saturday morning program in those days, and I was actually on the air, one of the first shows on the air after the collapse. We should mention we're approximately, what, 6-7 blocks from Ground Zero right now. We broadcast out of 120 Wall Street. And And outside of just taking calls and talking to people about that, in terms of doing arts, certainly any kind of comedy, certainly any kind of material, it was very difficult to even approach the subject for a long, long time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I started doing my study that is the result of which is this book I just published, but I started interviewing the second week. And sometime in the 20s, sometimes within 2 to 3 weeks after 9/11, I did an interview with Janet Coleman. And I remember coming down here in the evening, and this was right outside the BA offices at 120 Wall Street, where there was one of the staging areas for the first responders. And there were lots of army, people in full military gear with
them, right outside.
Right outside, and yeah. All the first responders in the military and walking over the wires and going through security. You know, it's not exactly the sort of atmosphere in which you would think a place like BAI would be operating, but you didn't have much choice. And it was very moving, actually, to talk about my early interviews with survivors and witnesses on BAI with Janet, within 2.5 weeks after the
disaster. Well, we do like to think that we and you and the people in this room are exceptional in having the ability to think and cope with this.
Well, I think reportage was valued immediately. I mean, that was, I think there was an audience for that. I do think that fiction and the other arts, elaborations on the basic events, I think it took longer for people to be willing to listen or read that kind of material. But interviews with survivors, interviews with the responders, that kind of thing, I think that was treasured almost immediately.
Yeah. You know, there's a shelf of books about novels about 9/11, and I think most of them, except for the Jonathan Safran Foer, are really pretty second rate. I mean, I think Netherworld by Joseph O'Neill is sort of good, but a notch down from the Foer's book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. But it is very hard. I don't think creative people have, for the most part, with those two exceptions, have really intelligently engaged the meaning of 9/11.
Well, I felt that 9/11 books immediately were kind of like those World War II novels, that they were written because people expected that they would be written. One of the paradoxes was that World War I produced classics. It produced classic poetry, it produced classic novels, All Quiet on the Western Front. World War II didn't really to that extent. It was forced. It was stuff written because it was supposed to be written. There was a lack of spontaneity about it that I think was true of a lot of the, especially the novels that were published close to the event.
Well, the only exception, you know, Norman Mailer, who graduated from Harvard in 1942, and he joined the Army. We were just talking about Mailer a minute ago. He joined the Army in order to have a war experience so he could write the great war novel, and he published at 25 years of age, he published The Naked and the Dead in 1948. And so, you know, there's been nothing even remotely like that for 9/11. And you know, it's a different event, a different a different era and stuff. But I think that is the one exception to the World War II literature.
I also think that in 1948, novelists, fiction writers, were more central to people's awareness. I don't know why I looked at this, but I saw it was an ad for, I believe, rum, or it might have been cigars, I forget. But it's a man, I guess it must have been cigars because he's smoking a cigar, and his name is never given. It's Ernest Hemingway. He's well enough known as a face in 1955 that you don't have to tell people who he is. I don't think that there's a writer now, a serious writer now, of whom that could be said. I mean, Stephen King is probably recognizable, but that's only because he's appeared in movies. Fiction itself is less central. Novelists, we don't sit around waiting to find out what the novelists think about things at this point. That is a difference.
Actually, George Martin and Neil Gaiman are trying to change that with their HBO connections.
It may be that they will do that, but are we really going to wonder what it is that Neil Gaiman thinks about great public events? Novelists were expected to have something to say about the events of the time.
Yeah, this event, though, is also so difficult to encompass, and I think the only way, with the exception of those two novels I mentioned, that really the literature misses the mark because they both stay too close to it, and they're too far away from it. And I think the beauty of this story is that, you know, as you say, you use some of your own experience and you use anecdotes so that you have that immediacy, and yet you build this at times sort of wildly fictional account. I mean, there's a lot of fantasy here, but there is a hole in the city. I mean, and you imagine that hole in the city in ways that people can relate to. So I think it may be the only fictional approach that is effective in trying to creatively comprehend something like 9/11.
It had in some way to be non-realistic because the realism of the event had been covered so thoroughly on television. We all knew what it looked like. I saw it happen from the street. I watched the towers fall down from about a block away from where I live. That we didn't need. We didn't need anyone to tell us what it looked like. We did perhaps need someone to tell us what it felt like.
Well, yeah. I mean, but again, significant American writers from Philip Roth to Don DeLillo have written novels about really bad novels. And they join an even larger shelf of somewhat lesser known writers who are serious writers. And they just haven't found a way of capturing what it means. And I don't know whether another 10 years is going to be required or another 50 years. But we are at a point where it's both. And the 10-year anniversary is really an interesting anniversary because I think it's the point at which individual experience and individual trauma enters into historical memory. And there becomes something larger, so that I think there may begin to open up that space for many ways of thinking about it historically, psychologically, but also creatively.
So today's a major landmark.
Oh,
in the
absolutely.
Psyche.
Ten years away.
Terribly
yeah.
important.
Yeah.
Terribly important. And that's why they had to finish the memorial. That's why they, were spending, working 24/7 for the last couple of months because they were behind.
Finally. Yeah.
Yeah. That finally did spur them to do it.
We have about 5 minutes left. And I'm thinking if we can, if listeners want to call up, and you have to be very, very on target and very brief, pithy, in fact, you can give us a call here at WBAI at area code 212-209-2900. And headphones are required to hear the phone callers as they come in.
We will, of course, point out that this is a recording, so you can call that number, and Rick is here, but you're not going to get to join this recorded conversation.
The impact of this fiction itself, I have a personal, as an advocate of speculative fiction, a personal view, as Chuck said, it is in some way science fiction, speculative fiction, that really helps the mind get around this in the earlier days, even if they're 2.5 years later, that made it so relevant. We may not, by the way, it's conceivable, we may not be able to do calls. We were off the air just before we went on, and the reason for that probably involves phone lines. So in that case, we are certainly just going to continue. Let me thank, by the way, there are a lot of people that made this morning's show happen. Of course, Janet Coleman and David Dozer, whose program this is, Grayson Challenger, Jake Glantz, and John L. Miller, who brought us back on the air, and Tony Bates and Kathy Davis, the programming department of WBAI, and Ken Gale, our ops person. So I just wanted to get that out of the way before we actually have to go off. And I don't see calls coming in, so I'm going to assume that we do not have phone access at this time, which brings me back to 10 years ago. We had no phone access.
Nostalgia.
Yes, of a kind that it was a fascinating time right here then, because we had two huge trucks outside the building, you may remember, Chuck, that were basically working as batteries. They were supplying this building with electricity so that eventually there would be phone service and so that we were able to broadcast. And right outside was, as you said, a first responder center. It was an army base, basically, and a steakhouse was giving free food to anybody with the proper ID as a responder. It was an extremely surreal moment.
I think that combination is worth remembering. The right outside WBAI was both a first responder base and a kind of and it was a kind of a military base. And there was a militarization of Lower Manhattan. And because it was closed off for most New Yorkers, they didn't really appreciate the military presence in Lower Manhattan. It was both I experienced it as both terrifying and reassuring at the same time.
The phone service in the village was really kerfuffled. At one point, I picked up the phone, and this voice said, "Please get off the phone line. This is Naval Intelligence." And it may just have been I don't know what it was. But
that famous oxymoron.
Well, I don't know what it was, but it may just have been somebody, you know, who wanted to continue his phone call. But, yeah, suddenly we realized how many... Well, all of the kids who were in the National Guard were called up. I mean, they were driving huge trucks around Manhattan and having the time of their lives.
Right. No, parts of Manhattan there were tanks coming down West Side Highway.
Yep.
I mean, it was a scene. In fact, for me, and I was all over Manhattan, most evocatively right outside BAI. It was a scene out of the movie The Siege.
Yes.
The Lawrence Wright movie in 2000, you know, and that's after the whole point of the siege is after a major terrorist attack, and then the military takes over, and then there's this tension between the police and the military, and you know, that's what we could face. I mean, I think that's that kind of image has certainly been in my mind in the 10th anniversary. You know, what if there's something else in the future? What will be the response?
It was war imagery in the United States, and we have not had that really for decades and decades. That was part of the power, I think, of 9/11, but it was war in this country, war in this city.
No, we felt that we were at the center of the war zone.
Yes.
You know.
Well, in fact, we were. So,
yeah, that's part of the whole of the city.
Yeah, my immediate reaction with my partner Barbara was on the 12th. We actually just left New York. We had to go just, you know, separate ourselves from that feeling, that warlike feeling that was impending upon us. We drove maybe 100 miles out to Pennsylvania, went to a motel, and what did we find in the restaurant there? Firefighters. New York firefighters sitting around a table. Glumly, I would say. Huh. And just that idea that here we went for respite.
Well, possibly so did they.
Well, I'm sure that's exactly what it was, but it certainly had that war zone feel.
Right. One of the things that... By the way,
we only have a few seconds left. So
seconds? Well, go. I'll just say the firefighters came from all over the country. You know, there were tens of thousands of people working on the fire, on the pile, and including firefighters from, you know, from Illinois, from California, from... So it was a kind of a national firefighter's presence.
Police also. There were police from little towns trying to manage New Yorkers in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of national, we are going to National Pacifica Radio in a little under 60 seconds. That will be the Pacifica Radio broadcast, 9/11's footprint on America a decade later. And then later on this evening, Max Schmid and Sydney Smith will be taking your phone calls, hopefully, to discuss this. But let me thank again Dr. Charles B. Strozier and Richard Bowes for making this show possible this morning.
Thank
you. We're going to actually record a little bit more that WBAI listeners will be able to access sometime later. Again, rickbowes.com is one place. And Chuck, where do people contact you?
I have a center at my centeronterrorism.org.
Okay, very good. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Stay tuned to Pacifica Radio and WBAI all day. This is WBAI in New York. And somehow, amazingly, this continues to be WBAI in New York. Now,
There's another 21 minutes to this recording, but there's another 6 minutes to this radio program.
These are the paradoxes of time.
Yes, indeed. Time and space.
Yes, that also.
Yes,
but so, mainly time in this case.
But there are those people that have the entire thing because they are people that when we offer this...
Had the foresight and the daring to buy one of these extremely rare, although for you, nothing is too rare.
I'm keeping this one.
You're keeping...
This is the one that was edited properly, as opposed to the one I played last year, where in the middle of the thing, it's, Rick, would you read that line again?
Yes, it was great.
Yeah, I'm still, like, cringing over that one.
I forgave you.
Yeah. What about the listeners? I mean, people making fun of me, deservedly so.
Well, you know.
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, yes,
tragedy. What is tragedy except comedy and drag? I mean, you know. It's
This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, as you've been hearing on recording, Richard Bowes. That is a stunning story.
Had I known...
You've written a number, but that one holds... from the fact that I produced that reading, and I think...
It's an excellent reading. I mean, I can barely believe that that's me speaking. If I had known...
It's better than the chipmunk version that we broadcast of that one.
The chipmunk version, with Alvin, you mean? Alvin, stop. Really? Was there a chipmunk version?
There's a chipmunk version of it.
The reading alone
is 34 minutes without the intro or anything. And I was given a half hour time slot.
Oh, I remember that. You cut little parts of it out. Yeah.
I didn't cut any of the words out.
But the words came tripping out. I was speaking like this real quickly and so...
And I used the variable speed things.
I loved it.
A little bit faster. I have the recording of that, but
I spit those words out like machine gun bullets. Oh, it was.
But so that's the chipmunk for and it's such a great story. You need to take your time with it because so many people listen to it and they don't know where it's going. And people online, if you Google up, there's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes. It's Bowes, who, by the way, you can find at rickbowes.com. If you Google up that story, which I did do tonight before I came here. Somebody will say, this is the best 9/11 story. And the people are, they still don't quite get, truly, without listening to it or reading the whole thing through, they don't see where it's going. They don't see the depth and the brilliance and the undercurrents that you have in that story, which as Chuck Strozier was talking about there, are really resonate in just so many ways.
Why, thank you. As I say, if I had known, I'd do it all the time. You know, I'll write stories like that. The story that I wrote before this one wasn't, like, on that level, and the story I wrote after it wasn't on this level.
Well, this one had been germinating for you for quite a while.
Must have, although I was unaware of it. A lot of it is actually autobiographical.
Obviously.
My stories tend to be autobiographical, but this one really...
Especially the ones that are true, like some of those Boston stories.
Yes. Yes. The Boston stories, yes. The underwear collector, you mean, and stuff like that.
You haven't read that one on the air yet.
Oh, I haven't, and
no,
I should.
No, you haven't. You're going to have to.
I'm going to have to read the underwear.
Yeah, we need you
in
to
Boston,
get you to do that.
In Boston.
You did tell that whole story in WBAI because you told it to Sidney Smith. You told it to Uncle Sidney, but that wasn't on the air. That was in the newsroom at 120 Wall Street.
In 1960 in Boston, there was a gentleman who, if you were a teenage boy, would buy your underpants from you for $3. But you had to take them off in his presence and hand them to him. And in his apartment, he said he had the undershorts of 33% of the teenage boys in Boston. Years later, somebody sent me something.
Were they laundered ever?
They didn't. I believe they had been, because they were stacked quite nicely. And it was all boys wore, like, jockey shorts at that point. That's all anybody was. So there were occasional boxer shorts, but mostly it was that. And years later, somebody sent me a newspaper article, and it was, he was on the bad side of Beacon Hill, and there was a fire in the building. The firemen came, and they were putting it out. He came rushing back. He had, and ran into his apartment, and the firemen thought he was running in to rescue somebody, and they hauled him out of the building, said, "No, sir, there's nobody in there." He broke loose, and he ran back into the apartment, and they followed him and found, like, 35,000 pairs of undershorts. Also, they were really mad because he, you know, was distracting them, and he went to jail or something. I don't know what happened, but yeah, that's a beautiful story. As I tell it, it's sentimental. It'll bring tears to your eyes.
And,
yes, or something.
Depends on the bleach that was used.
Yes, and I will read that.
Yeah, you have to.
Now I have to.
So, listeners, that's a prelude. You know,
that's a threat. That's,
you know, and maybe we'll do it, you know, the next fundraising drive. And guess what we'll have for a premium?
Yes, underpants.
You know, Hanes for everybody.
We want to get our Hanes on you, as they
absolutely. Or actually, some people want to get the Hanes off you.
Right. Yes. Well.
Yes. And we'll all be jockeying for position,
so
on the
to speak.
Air.
Yes. Yes. Ah. Yes.
But we'll try to keep it brief.
The noise she made could wear the knees off a brand new pair of BVDs. Do you remember that?
Oh my God!
Because she had dimples on her fingertips.
Jesus. Oh, my God. This has been Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. My guest has been Richard Bose. My name is Mutt. My name is Jim Freund. And I will be back next week with I Don't Know What. The week after that. No. Next week will be Veronica Shanus. Or it's the week after that will be Veronica Shanus, making up for 2 weeks ago when Rick Bowes
substituted,
filled in for Veronica.
I substituted and imitated her voice. It was amazing.
It was perfect. Yeah.
It was
amazing.
Really just astounding.
Yeah, so now in order to... we're collecting on the air all the Shirley Jackson Award winners between Sam J. Miller, who was on the show about a month ago, and Veronica Shanus. So it's collect them all.
Well, you don't have Chris Barzak.
Well, I have. That's not because he hasn't been repeatedly invited. Your godson.
My godson, yes. My
who has a movie out that's called...
Jamie Marx is Dead. And, yes, it's not so much available in theaters at this moment, but you can get it on Netflix and Amazon.
Is it now on Netflix and Amazon?
Yeah, I believe.
I will watch it this weekend.
You should watch it. It's wonderfully depressing.
The book was. Yeah.
Well, it's very true to the book, and the kids that they have in the parts are very, very good indeed.
This week, Lister is here for his show. Burn Baby Burn Clapper is coming your way in just 2 minutes.
Two minutes?
Yeah, oh, yeah. And my theme is welling up in the background.
So much different than your music.
Rick, thank you again.
Why, thank you for allowing me on your show.
And There's a Hole in the City is the first chapter of Dust Devil in a Quiet Street,
which is currently on the shortlist for the World Fantasy Award,
which will be given out in October.
November,
sorry. So everybody turn Wittershins and think good thoughts
and go out and buy the book.
And definitely go out and
all
buy the book, or stay at home and buy the book.
Other people who have been nominated have people who go out and buy their books.
So should you. Thanks, Rick. Thank you, Lister. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, Steel Iceman.
said I am a proletarian. I am. Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Cause my hurt is internal, the American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm messy attacked. The flag, I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the message must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to stole me? When I torched the flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, a
I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.